Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, taxi, RV, camper, your parents' basement, loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. You're listening to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada, affiliate talk radio, AM 640. 45 years ago, when plane hijackings were almost a weekly occurrence, one in particular captured the public's imagination and would go down in history as one of the most famous and unsolved crimes and mysteries in American folklore. I'm speaking of D.B. Cooper. Cooper, not his real name, hijacked a Boeing 727 aircraft in the airspace between Portland, Oregon and Seattle, Washington on November 24, 1971. He extorted $200,000 in ransom, which is equivalent to about $1,170,000 in 2016 dollars, and he parachuted to an uncertain fate. He was never heard from again. In hours 3 and 4, you'll meet the man who assembled a cold case squad consisting of former FBI agents, pieced together bits and pieces of evidence which allowed them to pick up the trail of Cooper once again, and ultimately, they insist, or he insists, solve this case. D.B. Cooper, case closed, 45 years later. And that's in hours 3 and 4 tonight, this morning on Coast to Coast AM, when we're joined by former journalist and media executive Thomas Colbert, author of The Last Master Outlaw, How He Outfoxed the FBI 6 times but not a cold case team. In the first half of the program, documentary filmmaker Ali Siadatan's introduction into the world of ufology began with a personal sighting of an enormous craft while traveling in his native Iran. In 2006, he produced a wildly successful film, UFOs, Angels, and Gods, which placed the modern-day UFO phenomenon within the biblical narrative. His latest project, soon to be released in installments, is called Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans. And it connects the dots between the modern-day alien abduction phenomenon and passages in the Bible which describe how fallen angels took human wives and produced a race of hybrids called Nephilim. So, come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Born in Iran, Ali Siadatan has been involved in a lifelong search into spirituality. He feels that the hand that has guided him through life has led him into the examination of the relationship that exists between angels and UFOs. After finishing a master's degree in French language and literature at the University of Toronto, Ali decided to pursue his passion for the Chinese arts of Kung Fu and Tai Chi and opened a center. Today, joined by his wife Shelley, they run a martial arts and health center in downtown Toronto. His documentary, UFOs, Angels, and Gods, was his first attempt at directing and writing for the audio-visual arts. His research into UFOs has inspired him to write a fiction book that he's working on and is currently in production on his second documentary film, Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans, which features interviews with Dr. David Jacobs, L.A. Marzulli, among others. Ali Siadatan, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm very good, Richard. Thank you for having me.
Let me lay out the game plan here for our listeners for the next couple of hours. You're going to take us from the modern-day UFO and alien abduction phenomenon back to the Old Testament and make the connection between the alien abduction phenomenon and the days of Noah. First of all, let's begin on a personal note how this journey began for you, and that is your own sighting of a large craft in Iran. When was that exactly?
It was in 1997. I was visiting my father and his wife, and we were driving at night from the capital, Tehran, to a city in the south called Shiraz, and we were going to spend an 11-hour drive, and we were going to sleep in a town in between Isfahan, which I believe has 6 million people living in it. We're driving after midnight, and there was a highway. two lanes. Cars coming up the other lane, we're going south, and that's it. And there's no lights other than the oncoming traffic, the headlights. And there's, you know, small villages with restaurants that you can have a pit stop. It's kind of an Arizona-like desert. It's not sand dunes. It's rocky. We're driving, and I have my back to the passenger door, speaking to my dad's wife, who is the one driving, and my dad is sitting in the middle of the back seat. I'm talking to both of them with my back to the passenger door, and then suddenly my dad's wife points out the window behind my head, and she says, she just makes these incoherent sounds, like, wah, 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 wah. And I don't pay attention. I'm too caught up in what I'm saying. My dad looks at her and says, "What's wrong, Nima?" And he then looks in the same direction, and now they're both doing this. And it catches my attention. I sit properly in my seat and look out the window. And a few hundred feet away, I see this large, large object. It's round. It has many, many floors. I can see that definitely there's structure here. If it was sitting on the ground, it would be a 3-4-story building. It was slowly coming down and has green lights all around it to the point where the whole thing is glowing green. But I can see that there's lots of green lights on it. And it's coming slowly down, eventually perpendicular to my window. And I thought that I saw in the black of the desert night this black tube. It come out from the ground, and this thing went on top of it, and it just went into the ground, and the tube was like the same color as the night.
Now, this is a busy highway or a busy road. Are other cars at this point pulling off the road, or people getting out and looking at it, or what's going on?
Well, my dad felt that it was safer to drive. People speed like crazy in these highways, and my dad felt it was, he preferred to travel late at night so there'll be no traffic. And so we had left Tehran past midnight. This isn't truly in the middle of the night.
Okay, so not a lot of cars on the road. So again,
yeah,
you're seeing this immense, at this point. An immense craft. How low is it now in the sky?
How low is it? Eventually, it is the same height as the car as it goes down into the earth itself. But when it was right there, I'd say it was maybe 500 feet up, and then it just went straight down. It was immense, like he was huge. As it was coming down, I could feel its presence of this very large object. That was kind of sat in my seat all shocked, in a state of shock. And then she said, "You know, did you see that? Did you see that?" And he said, "I did." And then we just drove, and we didn't talk too much about it until I came back home here, and I was a couple of years later making this documentary, UFOs, Angels, and Gods. And he called me, and we were speaking, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm making this documentary." And he didn't say anything, and I was surprised. And then I said to him, "Do you remember?" And then he yelled out, "That green thing on the road to Isfahan." I said, "Yes." And then I realized for the first time that my dad, too, had seen a green thing. But it's interesting how you just push the information down. There's a social conditioning. Like when I came back, I felt I was crazy if I talked about it. Somehow I was feeling that pressure. And then when I started to look on the internet, I realized, well, this was very common, and many, many people all around the world were seeing the same thing. But now I could believe it because I was one of those people.
Right. And you're right that people that have this experience, that share an experience like this, it is so common, oftentimes they don't discuss it amongst themselves ever again.
Yes. We had gone down to Convocation Hall here in Toronto to film a convention where Paul Hellyer was going to talk for the first time about his UFO sighting.
Right.
He was the Minister of Defense under Trudeau. And we thought, we'll just film the people outside and get their idea why they're here. And we couldn't believe how many people said to us, no, they don't want their colleagues at work. They work in banks. They work in the downtown financial district. They don't want their colleagues to know that they came to such an expo.
Right. Now, this sighting, almost 20 years ago, were you a Christian at this point?
Yes, I was a Christian at this point, yes.
All right. Now, after you saw this, and this is prior to your making your film, UFOs, Gods, and Angels, how do you take this sighting that you
Sorry,
experienced?
How do I what?
How this sighting that you had, that you experienced,
yes,
how does that correspond to references in ancient texts, the Old Testament, for example, ancient myths of things that have been described as flying chariots, for example?
Well, it was, what do you do with this information? It was a gradual process of exploration. I was, you know, vaguely familiar with, let's say, the ancient astronaut theorists, you know, had read a few Eric von Däniken books, two of them, I think, at that point. And, you know, there was this idea that people out there were seeing things, even astronauts were talking about it in the present age, that they were seeing things. Gordon Cooper, they all talk about it, Buzz Aldrin. And but now it was all very real to me. It was like, whoa, wow. So looking into what people were saying before the 20th century, I noticed that there was an awakening, and it had started with Sputnik, the idea that we could leave this place. Perhaps others had arrived. So there was the ancient astronaut theorists pointing to all this amazing architecture, like the stone at Baalbek, like what we see in Machu Picchu, and many of these very, very ancient architecture we find, and saying, well, you know, obviously this was very advanced technology. We now see that. And suddenly the idea that these sightings were also in the Bible, this was then introduced to me in my search by someone pointed to the Ezekiel passage where we see Ezekiel, he witnesses this fire, this brimstone. If you watch Spielberg's movie, Close Encounter, what is it called? Close Encounter of the Third Kind.
Right.
If you watch that movie, you will see there's a boy on a farm looking out, and he sees exactly, and I'm convinced he took it from Ezekiel, the amber colors, and then inside of it there's essentially a saucer. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. Where else do we see this in the Bible? And so as I started to look, I realized that, yes, in the Bible there are many mentions of chariots. People leave the earth like Enoch or Elijah, and there is chariots of fire, we are told, which in Hebrew the word is Markaba, which means vehicle, actually. The only reason it was translated as chariot was because until the 20th century there was no other thing other than a chariot. So there are vehicles in the Bible, and even prophetically, Isaiah talks about how God returns with his Merkaba, with his chariots, in order to bring judgment, fiery judgment on the earth, prophetic passages. And of course, we know in Christian thinking that the Lord returns with an army of angels. So suddenly, all of these passages, the star, the magi's follow, the pillar that the sons of Jacob follow out of Egypt, and even the cloud in which the Lord ascends and leaves, and we see him prophetically that he comes through the Ancient of Days also in a cloud into the presence of God. So what is this cloud that carries him all the way to the presence of God? Suddenly, all of these ideas of angels coming to the earth and leaving the earth, looking through the eyes of the Hubble telescope into the heavens and seeing the creation in a way that no other generation could have seen it before us.
Right.
And having this
let me just remind listeners, Ali Siadatan is with us, documentary filmmaker, Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans, Think Again Productions. Well, if we're going to talk about flying vehicles in the Bible, And we look at the characters that inhabit the biblical narrative, we need to explore then the physical nature of God and angels, because many of us, I think, are operating under the assumption that God and angels are non-physical beings. They're spirit. They don't require a physical flying vehicle to get around. So how do we reconcile that?
Well, look, let me start first with the angels. I'd say that in the Bible we see tremendous amount of instances of angels being physical. Like in Sodom, we are told that the men of Sodom found these angels to be so handsome that they wanted to have sexual relations with them. We see Abraham sharing a meal with God and two angels. We see angels killing the Assyrian army. We see the Messiah, who we believe is the incarnation of God, returning from the dead and saying, I have flesh and bone, I am not a ghost, making a point of that, and then asking for to be given food to eat. And of course, there's nothing more spiritual in the whole of the Bible than, you know, the God in himself. So we see that the physical nature of God and angels is well established in the Bible. People say, well, fine, that's because they're kind of these energy beings, and for a moment they take on a physical form to appear to us, talk, and then leave. But that is really an assumption, and that goes back to ancient Christian thought, back to Europe, back to Rome. It's natural. You need a post-it note. How do you understand something so complex? You know, perhaps they were drawn with bird wings by the painters in the Renaissance in Europe. Fine, you have to explain how they come and go, where they come from, where they leave. But now that we see the universe and that we see that God himself was resurrected in physical form, we may consider perhaps that this thing we find ourselves in is a worthy enough place to be the theater in which the story of the Bible unfolds. So as far as the scriptural evidence shows us is that they are physical, there are chariots involved, and that the universe is a vast place. Now, we don't want to go to the other extreme and turn it into like Star Trek and superimpose our primitive understanding of how the building blocks of the universe may fit together or how we may cross it. We don't understand these things. So we don't want to go to another extreme and make it comical, like Gabriel is sitting in a vessel and the pilot is like, we'll get there soon, sir. And it's, you know, it's not that comical either. This is something that crosses time and space, and we are told that there are seven heavens in the scriptures, and the universe is the third heaven. So I don't know. It's too complex, but definitely there are vessels involved. Where they go, how they get there, how they operate, all of these are still mysteries. But the scriptural evidence and the empirical evidence outside of our window, both from the Bible and from many other traditions of our ancestors, and what we see outside our window, all point to actual vessels.
All right, so let's talk about some of the characters in the Bible. There is God, of course, but the Bible also speaks of gods, plural, sons of God, the daughters of men, and of course the Nephilim, which we'll get around to when we talk about Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4.
Yes.
So, which character shall we begin with? Where do you want to dive in here?
Well, I think that maybe we should start with God, since you also asked about God. So I think that God cannot be put in any box whatsoever, and that we have to give God the complete freedom to be and do whatever he pleases. He can be inside of time and space and be physical and be in a place. He can be everywhere. He can inhabit eternity. He can be an energy, a spirit. God is definitely without, and we can't put him in a box. But so we can only observe, okay, God seems to be a spirit, God seems to inhabit eternity, and God seems to be in the physical universe where many other beings have been created, including Adam, as far as we know. And so these other beings, they are called the gods, and that's how they're translated in English. And even though I think English is wonderful, but there are times where the Hebrew comes and clarifies things, and I would say this is one of those times. In the Bible, there is this word, Elohim, and it covers this multitude of spiritual beings that we see in the Garden of Eden, that we see governing the nations, and we see God having a relationship with them. We see in Psalm 82, verse 1, that he is the God of gods, the Elohim of Elohim, and that he is in the council of Elohim. In the council of these gods, we see that they are told to worship him. They are admonished. For instance, at the time of the Exodus, they are told, oh, you know, you're being judged with the Pharaoh, the spiritual powers behind.
Okay, so who are the sons of God then? Who are these sons of God that are part of this council?
So, well, yes. So
who are they?
These beings, the Elohim, have many categories inside of them, and it seems that one of the categories inside of them is the Benai HaElohim, the sons of God. And of course, God himself is the creator of all of these beings. He is separate from his creation, and he's referred to as the El of the Elohim. He's the El of the Elohim, the might of the mighty ones. And so God is in the midst of these beings, And some of these beings, come, the sons of God, they are called. We see them in the book of Job. When the earth itself is created, we are told they are here with God as he creates the earth. And we see that they are with Satan as Satan comes to have a conversation in the divine court that is, you know, been recorded for us to consider. And it concerns us, concerns one of us, Job. And we see the sons of God in that story with Satan. And then we see them, as you pointed out, in the book of Genesis. And before that, we see them really in the creation story of Adam and Eve, where there's a plurality.
All right, Ali, just hold on here. Hold on. Let's take a time out. We'll come back, and we will address Genesis chapter 6, verse 1 through 4, where we first learn of the Nephilim, the sons of God, who saw that the daughters of mankind were beautiful, and they took any they chose as wives for themselves. Back with more of my conversation with Ali Siadatan, Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans. Here's Paul McCartney taking us into the break with Let It Roll. Hold on to your tinfoil hats, folks, because this is a good one. Alien hunters have found what they claim to be an unexplained shadow on Mercury, which is caused by a large structure. In a video posted on YouTube by Secure Force 10, viewers can see a black rectangular structure in a NASA photo of the Mercury surface, which conspiracy theorists claim could be an entrance of some kind. The object was first spotted in 2012 by UFO Sightings Daily, where Scott C. Waring reported it as a doorway more than 3 miles long. But in the new video from alien hunter Tyler Glockner, it may not be a doorway, but a huge rectangular monolith. You can read more, see the video. Greg Bishop, our webmaster tonight, has posted that up at the website, coasttocoastam.com. Join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained on his fabulous internet TV show, Beyond Belief. You can sign up for just 99 cents for the first month at beyondbelief.com and enjoy hours of fascinating past shows. When we come back, more of my conversation with documentary filmmaker Ali Siadatan as we discuss his project Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. All right, the alien abduction phenomenon and the Old Testament, the days of Noah, here's where the rubber hits the road. Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. When mankind began to multiply on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of mankind were beautiful, and they took any they chose as wives for themselves. And the Lord said, "My spirit will not remain with mankind forever, because they are corrupt. Their days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth both in those days and afterward. When the sons of God came to the daughters of mankind who bore children to them, they were the powerful men of old, the famous men." All right, Ali, help us sort this out. What is this? What is chapter Genesis chapter 6, verse 1 through 4? What is it telling us?
Well, it really sounds a lot like this whole idea of the abductions. The heart of the UFO phenomenon is the abduction phenomenon, and the heart of the abduction phenomenon is the creation of alien-human hybrids. And suddenly, the same way that the idea of chariots brought to life all of these stories of the flying gods, including the angels in the Bible, well, the story of abductions and the creation of human alien hybrids brought such stories of this, as this one to life. Suddenly, we had stories like this from virtually every country in the world. The Greeks called them Titans. The Indians and the Chinese, usually when we talk about their versions of it, we call them demigods in English. And the Hebrews had this story, which is supposed to be historical. This is meant to be something that happened to the ancestors of the Jews, the children of Noah, and before them, before the flood, even the parents of Noah, from between Adam and Noah, this world that existed. So we are to understand that there was a commingling of these entities, the sons of God and the daughters of Adam. Now, to understand what is going on, the abduction phenomenon makes the story perhaps real. We can consider it for the first time as something that happened then and it's happening now. So this is interesting, but why is it happening? In order to understand that, we have to zoom out and place it in the context of the larger tale. There is a big story happening here, and this is one piece of the puzzle. Let me take you a little bit into the larger story. Let's zoom out. Here's another verse that's very interesting. It's from Deuteronomy. It says, when the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. So suddenly we now see another role for the sons of God that gives us another clue into the picture. What is going on? What is the relationship between them and the human world? Well, it seems here that the Most High divided the nations. We know that happened at the Tower of Babel, where they were building something. You know, Zechariah Sitchin used to say it's a rocket. Others see it as a very tall tower, but something that was the focus of their pride and their unity. And there they were scattered. Their consciousness was modified. They were now speaking different languages, and the nations were divided and cast out. And now we're given a clue that they were given borders, that their borders were fixed, that God had imagined territories for all of these 70 nations mentioned in Genesis 10, but then that they were put under the authority of the sons of God. And so suddenly this makes all of these ancient gods, all of these entities that are worshipped by the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Persians, the Mesoamericans, the Indians, the Chinese, and of course, you know, no disrespect to anyone, we're all in the same boat, we're all humans looking for the truth. But according to this perspective, it seems that all of these gods were these characters, the sons of God.
And when, let me just be clear here, Ali, when you when you're talking about the sons of God, and earlier you mentioned this council, these yes. sons of God, are these the angels that rebelled?
Well, that the passage that really kind of gives us a really big clue into that is this conversation that Satan and Jesus have with each other. Where Satan says to Jesus that all of the kingdoms of the world have been given to his dominion. He says that to him. And if Jesus were to be kind enough to and respectful enough to worship Satan, God forbid, then Satan would give all of this to him to rule as his human representative. He would become the human representative of Satan, who's been given the dominion over all these kingdoms. So suddenly there's a connection there made there and in other passages between the head of the fallen angels, Satan, and these entities, these spiritual beings that were behind the nations. Another example of this conflict is in the book of Daniel, where Daniel is fasting and praying for 21 days. An angel arrives from the throne room of the universe, from the temple at the heart of time and space, to the earth, and he says to him, 21 days ago, God heard your prayer and sent me, but the prince of Persia withstood me for 21 days, to the point where this angel claims that he has to call for backup. And Michael, who is a mighty warrior, as far as we can tell, the one who arrests Satan at the end of this age, he arrives to fight the prince of Persia so Gabriel can, or this angel can come and deliver this message of scriptural importance.
Okay, let me just do a summing up here then. In other words, the 70 nations are under the dominion of the fallen angels.
Right. So the word fallen angel doesn't exist anywhere in the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. It is a word of Christian culture. And in the New Testament, the word angel becomes an umbrella word for all of these beings, the Elohim, the gods, the Malak, the messengers, even the sons of God, all of these things. And so it's a little bit confusing. In the Bible proper, all of these beings are called Elohim, and now this is their story, and from them, Adam is created. Adam is the son of Yahweh Elohim, the leader of all the Elohim, and that is why he is called the son of Elohim, and this is something that Jesus himself refers to when he's accused of making the same claim, that those who received the scriptures were, in fact, in their own book, called this, and of course he's referring back to Psalm 82:6.
Let me go back to Genesis and the sons of God mingling with the daughters of Adam, because I want to make sure that I'm understanding the language here. Because again, my understanding is, and you've sort of disabused me of this, that when we're talking about the council of gods, the gods that rebelled, I'm going to call them fallen angels, that rebelled, they took these daughters of Adam as their wives.
Well,
now, my understanding, again, is as fallen angels being of spirit, but they're not human. So how could they create offspring with humans? But then I'm looking at the language here, and it doesn't say they had sex. It just said the mingling with daughters of Adam. That's very telling, isn't it? Sons of God mingling with daughters of Adam.
It says that they knew the daughters of Adam and in the book of Genesis, and that is the language of sexual relationship in the Bible. Later on in the prophecies that point to a future time, it uses the language of mingling, and the Bible is very precise. In the book of Daniel, it says, they shall mingle their seed with the seed of man, in Daniel 2, verse 43. And this is, of course, prophetically pointing to what we're seeing today that is happening in laboratories where human and alien genetics is mingled together and hybrids are created on these vessels that the abductees are taken into.
But that would be asexual reproduction, wouldn't it?
That would be asexual, and that is the language of Bible prophecy. And that is interesting how precise the Bible is to create a distinction between the language that it uses to talk about what is going to happen in the future and the language of what we see happen in the past. Now, as far as, again, why is this happening? The language in the past is more sexual. And why is this happening? Well, there's a third passage. So Satan and Jesus have a conversation where Satan identifies himself as the spiritual ruler of all these dominions and kingdoms. But then there's a passage in the book of Revelation that gives us another clue, which says that one-third of the stars of heaven, which is an idiom for these beings, these luminous beings, they're always shining beings, that one-third of these stars have been pulled down by the tail of the dragon, which is the devil, we are told, in the book of Revelation. And so we now know that the numbers are huge, because each time angels are numbered, they are always numbered in the hundreds of the thousands of the hundreds of thousands. Incredible big numbers are given. One-third of them have followed this guy. Why? Because he has an ambition to become the number one principle of the creation, to be the one for whom the universe is made, and he wants God to hand them the scepter of universal rule. Of course, God will continue to remain God, but somehow he was going to play his cards right, and he's going to get this. And all of these, one-third of the Elohim, went with him. And a portion of those guys are the sons of God, the B'nai Elohim, who then engaged in this relationship.
Right. So why are they creating the Nephilim? And when we say Nephilim, we're also talking about giants, correct? Titans.
Yes.
So what is the end game here? What is the purpose of the fallen angels creating this hybrid race, these Nephilim? And that's where we get, you know, Goliath in the title of your documentary, Goliath Rising. All right, obviously,
yes,
one of the more famous giants in the Bible.
Yes,
what's the
right
purpose of that?
Well, now that we're kind of have been looking into it, I mean, I've been looking into this since the mid-1990s, and other people have been looking into it, and as the picture is unfolding and our understanding of what happened in the past is increasing, and what we're seeing today, we're seeing more, and I'll share with you, with your audience, more of what we're seeing today shortly, we're getting kind of a better picture. And again, we have to zoom out and see the whole, all the pieces at once in order to understand why are they doing this. When these gods are given these nations, once we see that the Bible is pointing to these beings behind the nations, not being mythological, but being real, and we start to go and look into these cultures, what we see is that a tremendous amount of knowledge is passed down from these other beings, the fallen angels, to these nations. We see that in the days before the flood, where the watchers gives all of this knowledge to the children of Adam. And this knowledge, it remains. Some of it is carted out by the sons of Noah, and we see architecture emerging. One of the most important pieces of knowledge given down was writing, and writing allows them to now speak their laws, which become the codes of the various civilizations. They give us worldview, they give us understanding of the afterlife, they make themselves objects of worship, because Satan and the fallen angels, they want to be the authorities. And it seems that when man was condemned to death and in the Garden of Eden, and he was let go, Satan and man found themselves in the same boat, both cast out. And so he becomes the ruler of this race, and is there from the beginning. The knowledge that is handed down by them shapes our understanding of reality, gives us worldview. These are the codes of civilization. And the thrones, he actually chooses rulers. We are told that the dragon has seven heads. There are seven empires that he favors above all. And so he sets up shop also on a power structure basis, gives worldview, and then begins the process of integration on a biological level. And that is where that brings us to the part of the plan, which is the Nephilim creation. The integration is not to be only from dominion, and you know, he has authority. It's not just political. It's not just worldview. You're going to believe and understand life in this way. It's going to be more than that. It's going to be a physical integration. He's going to completely absorb the human race, that it was made in the image of God, inside of his kingdom, inside of his dominion.
And herein lies the rationale, God's reasoning for the flood, because this integration has commingling between the sons of God, or the fallen angels,
yes,
and the daughters of Adam,
yes,
has essentially it contaminated the gene pool, save for one family. That would be Noah. So God decides to start all over again. Is that the idea? Wipe everybody out except for, again, this one pure blood family.
Yes, that is a very exceptional period in history. It seems that the contamination was so global. Were there people on the outskirts, far away from the Middle East, that didn't get contaminated? Perhaps. There are stories of survival in the high mountains. However, the contamination was so complete that all of the families of Cain first and then of the line of Seth were both contaminated to the point where there was no more humanity left other than one family who was, the Bible says, tamin, which means without blemish, and now we understand without this genetic combining. So the race then continues through him. But, as you read, the story of the Nephilim happens later on, and it says, whenever you see the Nephilim, then you know that it is a result of this knowing of the sons of God and the daughters of Adam.
So after the flood, the hybridization program begins anew, and again you have the fallen angels again commingling with the daughters of Adam.
It is one of the programs. There's the program of giving worldview and paradigms that encompass entire civilizations. They have territories, and they like to have their symbols on their territories. Like it says in the Bible, the nations are given boundaries, and the sons of God are the rulers of these boundaries. But then they have this program that starts in Genesis chapter 6 and continues from there. It is the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. The seed of the woman, in our first documentary, UFOs, Angels, and Gods, we explored it from the point of view that it pointed to a specific seed, that of Christ, and the seed of the serpent was the seed of the coming Antichrist. That was, in fact, what moved us to even make this documentary once this idea came to us. We didn't know that it was also coming to other people, so we spoke it. But in this case, I'm taking the perspective that the woman is also the mother of all living, because historically that passage is speaking to a specific woman, is speaking
right
to Eve. Is
but after the flood, when the Nephilim are created as well, and we have giants inhabiting the Holy Land and elsewhere, and we have Goliath who squares off against David, and of course it's interesting because Jesus, comes from the line of David. So one would have to wonder whether or not, as part of this satanic plan to forestall the arrival of the Messiah, was the idea that the Nephilim, Goliath, was supposed to slay David and therefore interrupt, you know, the lineage, destroy the lineage that produced Jesus Christ. Is that the mindset? Am I following here along correctly?
Yes. At this point, the idea of prophecies about the Messiah have been uttered, and we know that Satan reviews the scriptures because he quotes it in one of the temptations to Jesus. He quotes from Psalm 90, and so we know that he's kind of examining the plans of God. Why were there giants in that land? When you kind of look at that story, it's very interesting because once we see the tribes mentioned, the tribes of the giants mentioned in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 2 and 3, when Joshua and Caleb are going to take them on, and I'd like to come to that in a moment because it's a very interesting story. It's a fascinating story, and it is a type of the future Nephilim wars that are
and
ahead
we
of
will
us.
get to that, Ali. We're going to take a time out, and we will continue to discuss the race of giants, or several races of giants that inhabit the Bible, all part of our discussion revolving around Ali Siadatan's new project, Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans. Here's Elton John, Madman Across the Water, taking us into the break right here on Coast to Coast AM.